Good evening. Welcome to Coast. My name is Lisa Garb, and I am very happy to be with you tonight. My guest tonight is an accredited investigator of the paranormal. He is with the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, and he has covered very many aspects, especially hauntings, and he's been confronted with many different manifestations of other dimensions. I can't wait to talk with him. His name is Michael Lewis. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about a scientific angle and some of the equipment that he uses when he does his ghost hunting. We will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Lisa Garr. And tonight, my guest is Michael Lewis. Now, Michael has investigated everything from crop circles to UFOs. He's had such an incredible experience of many different aspects, particularly hauntings. And he's very familiar when he's confronted with sometimes these manifestations of other dimensions, he calls them. He is joining us from London, England. Welcome to the show, Michael. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. So I mentioned earlier in the show that you are an accredited investigator of the paranormal with the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. Can you tell me a little bit about that organization, ASSAP?
That's correct, yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
They are now the UK government-appointed body to train and regulate ghost hunters.
Regulate them? And why do they need regulating?
Well, with the emergence of TV shows over here, such as Most Haunted, there's been a lot of enthusiastic local groups spring up, and they're really in it for a thrill night, and they can do a lot more harm than good, and everybody here involved feels that it's better for the subject if we have serious, scientifically trained investigators who've done a training course. You know, I used to run them, in fact, for several years, and can be relied upon not to upset the witness. Often, of course, the witness is, dare I say it, scared to death. They don't know what's going on because, generally speaking, over here, the prevailing culture is very much against anything spooky. It's just laughed at and made fun of. And, of course, when it really happens, people get very scared and don't know what to do. So it's like going to a medical professional, really, when you've got an illness. You want to go to somebody who's been trained and knows what he's doing.
Who's had experience, exactly. So how do you, what amount of experience marks somebody who really is the real person, the real ghost hunter versus the...
Well, it's not really just experience, it's also attitude. You have to be impartial and consider everything equally, rather like the police in a murder investigation when they will follow up several different kinds of lead. And you really need somebody who's been trained. They might not have the experience. I mean, after all, if we say you've got to have some years' experience before you start, and they can't get the experience
right
until they've been accredited, you know, you're in a catch-22 situation. So it's not just experience. I think it's better to say that this training program and accrediting investigators has got to be something that's there and in place for people to go and get some training. Once they've got it, which doesn't last very long, then they can go out and do some investigation. Usually an investigator will go out with an experienced investigator, and that way you do have usually somebody who will be able to help and advise.
Okay. So let me ask you about your experience. How did you get started with your ghost hunting experience? Can you tell us a little bit about you, your story?
How did I get started?
Yeah.
Well, I'm 68 now, and mm-hmm. I think I've probably got to go back to the age of eight. When my parents went to a spiritualist church in Cambridge, England, where the university town where we used to live, and it somehow sparked something off. And I suppose you could say, you know, the interest was there was something always there that just needed something to spark it off. And after that experience, I began to take great interest in the subject. Early experiences were at the local vicarage of St. Mark's Church, Newnham, Cambridge. I used to go to that church and was friendly with the vicar's children.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go to parties there, and I suppose it was what you would call a real spooky place in those days, because it was surrounded by trees and undergrowth. In fact, when they had parish functions, they had to cut the undergrowth down so you could get it.
Oh, wow.
And it was really dark and gloomy and spooky, but the many times I went there, I was never given any indication at all that it was haunted. But some years later, when I had moved to London, there was a media furore resulting from a new vicar who'd just been offered the post of vicar there, and she looked through the window of the vicarage and saw a lady in Victorian, it's actually from the Georgian era, who was looked like a maid who was moving about inside, and she knew immediately there was no human being.
Because
unlike previous vicars, there had been two since I left.
Did you go back to see any of these yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes, well, I'm not really in the hope of seeing it, but there were all sorts of stories coming out, not all of which proved true, and as usual, when the media gets involved, they tend to get exaggerated, but it did hit the television news in this country, and I was absolutely astounded to hear that this vicarage, which I'd always thought of as very gloomy and been in many times, appears to be haunted by the ghost.
Did you ever notice that when you were there, when you were raised in that particular...
Well, it would have been when I was there, yes, but you see, they kept quiet about it. In England, ghosts don't exist, so if you see one, you know, in those days in particular, you just kept a stiff upper lip and said nothing.
Why would be? Could you would be considered crazy, or why?
I think the vicar at the time, who certainly wasn't interested in anything like the paranormal,
right.
He was in fact a bird watcher, and he very probably told his children not to say anything. I was able to contact one of them. To ask him about this, but unfortunately he didn't reply to my email, which reinforces my view that he was simply told not to say anything about it.
So,
and there are lots of cases like that where people just don't want to get involved.
Well,
perhaps for religious reasons, and
right.
They just.
Right.
They just don't tell anyone.
So, Michael, do you use specific instruments in order to detect?
Well, we do. Recently, ASAP, I'm not going to say the name in full again, ASAP has decided that instruments may not be entirely suitable and may give readings, erroneous, anomalous readings, which in fact has got nothing to do with ghosts. But yes, over here we do like to go around a little flight bags, I think they're called, and we have quite a significant number with the advance in technology.
What kind of instruments are they?
Well, you've got the basic recording instruments, an Olympus recorder, for example, which are now very small. When I first started out, there were large tape recorders you had to lug around. There's quite a few interesting devices for measuring temperature in more than one place, because you often get what are called the famous cold spots.
Okay.
Haunted houses, which appears to be energy being sucked from the atmosphere, resulting in a very cold spot. And we believe that particular energy is used to produce phenomena, because you've got to look at this scientifically. And we need to be able to measure rapid temperature drops.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So why would you coordinate having a cold spot with what would be a ghost? Why would that make sense?
Well, that's a very good question. It might not be anything to do with it, but it's just that this is an effect which has been noted in quite regularly, in fact, over the years, that haunted rooms do seem very cold, and the temperature does vary. And as I just said, a possible scientific explanation would be that an entity, if such does exist, might be withdrawing the heat from the atmosphere in order to use the kinetic energy to produce phenomena.
That makes sense. It does make sense. And so phenomena would be cloud-like or smoke-like type of energy, something that manifests?
Well, it can take all sorts of forms. Mm-hmm. It used to be wispy smoke-like effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I have taken one or two photos like that myself. You can get things like a blue haze or wispy smoke-like effect. But here I must point out that with the advent of digital photography,
mm-hmm,
and the digital age indeed, we are now getting a different type of phenomena on the new digital cameras, which are notably the famous orbs, about which there's much controversy.
Right. Tell me about the orbs. Do you think that they are an effect of the pixelation in the digital photography, unlike film? What do you think about orbs?
It could be, but this has been subject to quite a lot of intensive scientific investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the scientists do say that it is actually the camera is picking up something that is actually there, but may be too small for us to see. They say that there is actually something there, and they say the cameras are able to pick up minute particles of dust and things, and the larger and more detailed the orb is, the nearer to the camera it is. I think that's probably a good explanation as you'll get.
I wonder if you could actually zoom in on it.
Present state of knowledge, but I'm not saying that is a physical explanation for all.
I wonder if you could actually zoom in on an orb and if it would if you would be able to tell more specifically with a digital camera. So can you tell me, Michael, about one of your experiences where you did actually encounter one of these ghost-like figures?
Are you talking about an orb or an actual apparition?
An actual apparition.
Well, yes, these these experiences are rather rare, but the latest one was, I don't know, 5 years ago, here in North London, and actually about a couple of hundred yards from where I'm talking to you now, at the top of Barnet High Street, there was a store market site, which was being refurbished at the time, so it had hoardings and a large metal gate to stop people getting into the site. And in order to get from my house to the high street, I have to pass it. It's only about a distance of 200 yards.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been at home all day on those interminable do-it-yourself, I think you call it home mechanic.
Okay.
And my wife was away, so I nipped out to the nearest restaurant to get a meal in the early evening.
Okay.
Quite a few people about. And, of course, my mind, as always, was on the detail of the job that I'd been doing. And I think ghosts were probably quite... a long way, the last thing in my mind, that ping, I think, was my tablet.
Oh,
you heard it.
Darn.
I was walking past the boarded up entrance to the market, deep in thought, and... I suddenly became aware that there was a man, a bit taller than myself, I'm on the average height, in an old fawn Macintosh, which people used to wear, but it's really gone out of fashion, who seemed to be in by the boarded up entrance to the market, and he was carrying an old-fashioned linen bag, which people used to years ago. They were in fashion. I think they're coming back into fashion now.
Uh-huh.
And he appeared to be in a great hurry, and I suddenly became aware that he was trying to get past me. So I sort of automatically moved to one side as he hurried past me.
Was he coming towards you?
Walking, yes. Quite a swift pace.
Mm-hmm.
And, this happens every day on a sidewalk, I think you call them. And I really would have taken not the slightest interest had he not, in full view, it was still quite light, just vanished.
Mm.
And, of course, I suddenly came to with a bump, as they say, and... Where did he go? There was nobody else in the immediate vicinity, and I ran to the next road intersection and looked around the corner, and there was nobody.
There was no one there that you could turn to and say.
He brought me to reality that there shouldn't really have been anybody lurking in the gateway to the market. His dress was. Not of the current day, about 20, 30 years ago.
Did anyone else see him?
Well, no, you see, I did look round for other witnesses, but there was a couple walking along behind me, but they were quite a distance away, and they really wouldn't have seen anything.
Did you want to come back and bring your equipment and see if you could... detect anything in that area? Have you been
there?
Well,
I mean, it's probably true to say I walk past that market almost every day of my life.
Oh, interesting.
And I've never seen anything there or heard of anything. And who was he? Well, he must have been, to my mind, a shopper of about 20 or 30 years ago that you used to see in the market dressed like that.
Hmm.
He appeared to be somebody who was going about repeating the kind of thing that he used to do in this life. Now, why on earth I saw him quite clearly, I just don't know.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd love to ask you why you think that someone like that would reappear, and what those types of spirits have to finish or undone, or why they hang out in this particular realm. We will be right back. My guest is Michael Lewis, and you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Michael Lewis. He is an accredited investigator of the paranormal, and he's going to be joining us back to talk about some of his defining moments of his career and some very incredible stories about his ghost hunting and some of the hauntings that he's experienced. And in his way, which I absolutely love, with tons of color and texture to his stories. There's a lot of fun to talk to. And we will be right back. This is Lee Sigar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Lee Sigar, and my guest is Michael Lewis, and we are talking about what he's investigated, everything from crop circles to UFOs to ghosts and many, many different types of apparitions. And he once shared with me a story which I found so fun to hear about, because you have such a descriptive way of telling the story, Michael. It was in a particular pub. What brought you to this pub in the first place?
Well, it was at Leicester, which is a city in the East Midlands, and the pub was a very old pub called the Talbot, and opposite was Belgrave Hall, which was in fact not a country mansion, but it was quite a nice house owned by a Leicester businessman, the Ellis family, and it was quite a nice little setting there. I'm sure American visitors would have revelled in it, with the very old house and the pub opposite in what was once the village centre but was now a backwater. And we've investigated both the hall and the pub, but to tell you about the pub incident, we were on this occasion only investigating the pub.
Had somebody called you out about a particular sighting?
Or yes, the Belgrave Hall story is quite a long one, and I have included the extensive research which was done by quite a few people in my book, Conclusions of a Parapsychologist, which shows pictures of the hall and pub.
Oh, okay.
And the pub was known to be haunted as well as the hall, and we went into we were in the pub. It was a small group, I think, of about six or eight of us. And it was a beautiful summer night. And unusually for the Talbot, nothing happened. And I recall, as it got light, watching Vixen and her cubs wandering about in the road outside, and I could not recall a quieter night.
Hmm.
And we have breaks to check instruments and new tapes and this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about 4:30, something like that. It had just got light. I was leaning against the bar, not having a drink, I may add. There were two bars. I was alone at that time because we weren't on watch. My colleagues could be heard in the bar next door, and you can walk through from one to the other, and they were changing the film, and my colleague was upstairs because the landlord had gone away for the night.
And how many hours had you been there at that moment?
I could hear him moving about upstairs. We had all the pub lights on, and my attention was attracted by the figure of a man which walked through the passageway. There was a doorway to the bar serving area where I was, and he just moved across the doorway, and the movement attracted my attention. So I looked across the bar to see who this was as he entered the bar, and it was a man in a large duffel coat, which are not very popular these days, but they used to be. They had a hood that hangs down at the back. And he walked across the bar, and I looked at him, and he looked at me. So there was interaction there. And he went and stood by the door, which, of course, was locked and barred.
Was he walking?
And it occurred to me that I had the keys to the pub in my pocket. So how the hell...
He couldn't have gotten in the door. Michael, was he walking across the floor?
Yes.
It wasn't a floating motion,
quite
it was
normally,
walking.
Quite normally.
Did you hear the sound of his shoes?
No, I didn't. But I don't put any significance onto that, because it depends what type of shoes you've got. You're wearing, if it makes any noise, and it's time for floor. And I thought, now, he must be the pub cleaner, because a lot of pub cleaners have keys because they come in early morning to clear up before the landlord gets up. And I had not been told about any pub cleaner, and I thought, oh no, this is too much. We've been here all night, nothing's happened, and now the cleaner wants to sweep up. And as I thought that, I mean, I admittedly, I wasn't at my brightest at 4 o'clock in the morning. I thought, I'll have to challenge him and try and persuade him to not to walk about until we finished our coast time and give us another hour. And he walks back across the bar, and there was a small door that led to what was then a pool room of games and machines and things, and there was a pool table in the middle. And I could not see that from behind the bar. So when he walked across into the pool room, I followed him. I left the bar, walked around, went into the main part of the bar, through the door into the pool room, and I remember thinking, well, if this is a ghost, it's the biggest turn up of the book has ever been. And that's where he'd gone. There was no other exit. And I thought, I'm going to find the cleaner in here. And I walked into the room, completely empty. And because of the gaming machines, the windows had bars on them. So, you know, as soon as I walked in the room, I knew, wow, this is it. My fellow investigator was actually coming down the stairs. I could hear him as I walked through.
Did you have any of your equipment with you?
Yes, I had a camera on the bar right beside me.
Okay.
And like, so... so many investigators in this situation, I was so convinced that it was the cleaner that I didn't bother to take a photo.
Oh.
I always regretted that, obviously. What I would have got on, I think I would probably have got a massive light or something like that. I'm not certain I would have got the image of a man, but I saw him very clearly.
And You said that there were photos in the book, The Conclusions of a Parapsychologist?
Yes. There's actually a photo of myself with the ASAP president, the Reverend Lionel Fanthorpe, who's quite well known. He does TV presentations in the UK. And he is standing with me behind the bar, the exact spot where I saw the ghost. And there are other photos showing the pub and the hall.
Was there any history?
Story.
Was there any history of this type of man being there at the pub? Owner.
Yes, he's got a long history of haunting. On one occasion in that very bar, actually. The locals were having a drink, and one of them had got a full pint glass of beer, and he put it down on a round little table that they have in bars and pubs, full glass. And he sat down, and he was about to take a sip of beer, and his wife was with him and several other locals that he knew. And in full view of everyone, including the barman, the full glass rose into the air of its own accord, moved over, well, he was sitting next to it, but it then went over his head and poured the lot over him. That sounds too good to be true.
Yes, it does. Sounds like something from a movie.
That's one of the stories they made up. Barman himself told me, the landlord, that is, and he said that he witnessed it, the Japanese wife witnessed it, and several other people in the bar who were friends and were looking at him because they were talking to him witnessed it as well. So you've got several witnesses there. Now, the aftermath of this is very interesting. You might well ask, why would anyone want to pour a ghost want to pour a pint of beer over
someone's head, right?
And there's an answer here. Tristan Mattel, the barman, said, "Oh, I'm sorry, it's a ghost. It does do these things." And his wife fetched a towel from the kitchen, and the chap said, "Well, it's no good. I shall have to go and change my shirt. I'm soaked." So,
interesting.
By the time I will add that the other people in the bar had very quickly finished their beer and left in great haste, certainly emptied the bar. And anyway, the chap went home. He was a hot dog salesman, as it happened, but I did speak to him, and he gave me a very clear and lucid account. And he went home with his wife, and when they got home, they noticed that the security light at their house was on and the dog was barking. Now, of course, security lights only come on if
there's motion.
Triggered by perhaps an intruder or anyone, and pizza delivery man or anything, anyone going near the house triggers the light.
Okay.
And he couldn't find any trace of a break-in or of an intruder, but he thinks that somebody had tried to get it break into his house while he was around the pub, perhaps they knew he was around the pub. And that the glass of beer incident was meant to cause him to go home so that they will be disturbed. Now, you could say that's just coincidence, but when you think about it, if you wanted somebody to suddenly leave a pub,
it's a good way to get them to do it, absolutely.
That's a good way to get them.
Why do you suppose that some places are more haunted than others, or that the ghosts tend to coagulate around certain areas as opposed to others? Have you ever noticed?
more haunted than others. A simple explanation to that could be that not everyone wants to advertise the fact they've got a lot of ghosts.
True. unless it would attract people like you.
I think it would be true. You must remember over here we've got quite a lot of buildings that go back several hundred years. So there's been more of an opportunity, more residents have lived in them. There's statistically this they're more prone to be haunted, I suppose you would say. But an interesting thing occurred to us from an investigation we did in quite a nondescript, fairly modern building in London, which we investigated, and it appeared to have several ghosts, and in fact an object was thrown at investigators, including myself.
Oh, really? Maybe you weren't welcome there. Do you ever see them?
Tremendous crash, and we almost jumped out of our skin. Anyway, and there was nothing to account for it. But the point about this one was that it was situated within a few hundred yards of quite a large park, and one of the ghosts appeared to be that of a man been murdered in the park. It was drug related. The murder was drug related, but it was a case of mistaken identity.
Wow. Do you, Michael, ever work with the police departments around these specific types of maybe murders or?
Not really. No. We simply identified it, and we wondered how he got to this rather nondescript building down the road. And the answer appeared to be that the whole thing was sparked off when the barman in the building, who was quite an eccentric character, died suddenly, and he appeared to be one ghost. But we found that there were others, some of them associated with the building. But as is the case of this chap who'd been murdered, I don't think they ever solved it. It's like moths around a light. Spirits appear to wander about, and that they will go to, they will be attracted by another spirit. And you get quite a, I don't know what the name is for a collective of ghosts, a gaggle of ghosts. And they will congregate together. That seems to be what is happening.
The soul agreements that come together, I'm sure you've heard about that. Now, if you could indulge us for a minute, because we just have a couple minutes left, but I understand that you have some interesting perspectives on the death of Princess Diana. Could you share that with us?
I better be quick. I was chairing a group meeting of the Ghost Hunters group, and I said that if somebody ever presented me with evidence that Princess Diana had been murdered, I would consider it. Whereupon somebody in the audience, who I may say was a known skeptic, piped up and said that he'd been telephoned by a colleague who worked in the news media. That was true. We all knew that. And warned that she was going to be murdered on the continent, this continent of Europe.
Prior to the date?
2 or 3 days before it happened.
Mm.
And my informant just thought, oh, this is a load of nonsense, and didn't think any more about it until he woke up on the Sunday and heard the news. And what had happened was that there had been a very carefully worded memo to news staff warning them to be on their guard, so they weren't caught out by sudden news breaking suddenly.
Interesting. Well, Michael, we've run out of time, but your stories continue in your book, Conclusions of a Parapsychologist, and I appreciate you joining me from London tonight. I know it's early there for you, so thank you so much for your energy at this hour. I appreciate it. Michael Lewis is my guest, and we will be back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.